so ugly. What was Pete's Dragon something in your mind? How long ago? Because I mean, people remember. Some people remember it. Some people don't. It's a classic.
I saw it when I was six, and I haven't seen it since then. Mm-hmm. And so when the opportunity to direct it came, or to write it, first it was a screenplay that my writing partner and I were writing. That what appealed to us was that Disney didn't want to remake the original. They wanted to use the title, and obviously, if you use that title, you have to have a character named Pete, and you have to have a dragon. But beyond that, it was sort of open territory for us to kind of tell whatever story we wanted to tell. And I love family films. I love movies about kids. I love, you know, movies about children who are on adventures and who have friends who are animals or perhaps mythical creatures. And so I saw an opportunity to tell the type of movie, to make the type of movie that I might want to make under the auspices of it being a remake of Pete's Dragon. I saw it as a doorway, basically. And the original was not something that I'm not the type of director who has always been dreaming of remaking Pete's Dragon, always wanted to make a Disney movie. But both of those things came along and allowed me to make the type of movie that I wanted to make, which was really a lucky opportunity.
I saw you at the LCAP, and you said that the story of Pete's Dragon was similar to Ain't Them Body Saints, but with the dragon instead of Casey Affleck.
It's true,
I'm really curious what you meant by that. Can you elaborate on
that? It is a little bit of facetiousness on that part, on my part with that, but I really do think that both of those movies are about characters who are searching for home and searching for family. And in that movie, Casey Affleck was a guy who thought his family was one thing and thought that his life would be one thing, and it turns out not to be the case. And in his pursuit of it, he realizes that he's missed out on something. And so here we have a story of a little boy and a dragon who the little boy ultimately finds a new home as well. And the parallels became immediate to me when I realized there's a scene in this movie where the dragon goes and looks through a window and sees Pete with his new family curled up on the bed. And there's a scene in Ain't Them Body Saints where Casey Affleck walks up to a window and sees his wife and daughter sitting with a new guy on the couch. And, like, it's almost shot for shot the same. I didn't, wasn't conscious on my part, but I was like, oh, there we go. That's it.
What was the inspiration in setting it in the mid-to-late 70s, I'm guessing, is the time period? Because it's very unique. It doesn't really call out that it's a time period, except for some of the shirts and the key things you look at.
I like period pieces to begin with. I also think that if you set the story in modern times, it wouldn't work because people would take cell phone pictures, upload them to Facebook, and all of a sudden this secret that gets out into the world but somehow still stays a secret would not work. It would be a different story. And I also just think that if you set a story in the past, there's a little bit more room for magical realism in it. I think that's the reason why fairy tales often start with Once Upon a Time, because if it took place a long time ago, you get away with a lot more and you believe a lot more. And so that was helpful too. I love movies that are in indeterminate time periods. Ain't the Body of Saints was the same way. That had things from the 20s all the way up to the 80s in it. Here we kind of constrict ourselves to the 60s, 70s, and 80s, but we found that blend that just felt right. We never, like, explained it. You never see a newspaper, you never see a driver's license or a movie theater marquee that has a movie on it, but you definitely feel like it's vaguely in somewhere back there. And because you can't put your finger on it, you're able to also just forget about it.
Can you talk about why you decided to film in New Zealand versus here?
It was a very practical reason, which was we were planning to shoot in North America, and I'd said in the Pacific Northwest just because I think that's one of the most beautiful landscapes in the country, and so we were thinking naturally, like, oh, we'll go to Portland or Seattle or Vancouver. But the way our shooting schedule was lining up, it was going to be winter, and we could have waited, you know, 6 months, but we also could have just gone to the other side of the world where it was summer. And when we started to think about that possibility, you know, you have Australia and you have New Zealand, and we all know New Zealand from Lord of the Rings, and we know how majestic it is, and so that seemed immediately appealing. I'd always wanted the movie to be a version of the world that is seen through the eyes of a child, and when you're a little kid, everything is just bigger and more magnificent, more wondrous. And to me as an adult, New Zealand recaptures that for me. Like, I will look out the window when I'm there and I see things through a child's eyes because it's just so spectacular. And I'm being paid by the New Zealand Tourism Commission to say all this. So. No, not really. I'm going to be back there in 2 weeks for the New Zealand premiere. I can't wait just because it's such a special place.
It does look like it's a place in Portland. I mean,
it's very similar. Yeah. Like, it's very similar in terms of the topography and the type of trees, and so that's why it worked so well. But at the same time, like, there's only 4 million people in the entire country there, so you can get these like massive untouched stretches of land that stretch on for hundreds of miles that you just wouldn't get in the U.S. Wow. And so, even though we don't necessarily have that many like helicopter shots that utilize that, just having that feeling, that sense of primeval forestry, and it and that. That sense of untouched land was really, really important. And because the movie is set in a lumber industry, there's a lot of responsible forestry that's going on down there. And that was really great, too, to go see how that operation works and to bring that into the story as well.
Mm-hmm. How was the casting process? Do you have any in mind before? Or?
Bryce we had in mind from the beginning. And when I first wrote the script, we described the character as having red hair because I was like, it'd be great to have Bryce in this movie. And at first, it didn't seem like it was going to work out for scheduling reasons, but then ultimately it did, and I'm very, very happy. And then for the kids, you just always hope that you'll find great kids. Like, you kind of trust that you will when you're making a movie. Every single one of my films has had children in them, sometimes in lead roles, sometimes not. And you always wind up, you just look and look, and ultimately you find just the right kid for that particular movie. And in this case, I remember Oakes walking through the door in New York the very first time he auditioned, and just thinking like, "Oh, that's him. That's going to be Pete. We're done." And we sent that tape to the studio that night, and Alan Horn responded by saying, "Tell him to stop cutting his hair right now." And it was like it was just one of those things where it was very clear that that was the right kid for this movie. And one of the things that was great about him was that he could communicate so much without talking. Like, yeah. Some of his audition was entirely nonverbal. I just told him to go around in a room and build a trap out of everything you find in the room. I'm just going to watch you. And that was a huge, that was the most valuable part of that audition for him. And then with Robert Redford, I had been working on another project with him, and hopefully we're going to shoot that this year. But in the meantime, I had been working on this script, and when this one started to come together, and we were thinking of characters to play Mr. Meacham, or actors who could play Mr. Meacham, we had a different idea of who that character was in mind. And it was supposed to be sort of like a kind of crazier old guy, like a guy who like maybe doesn't have all his marbles, a little more comic relief. But then I was like, what if we got Robert Redford to play him? That would be unbelievable. And so I sent him the script, and he read it and was like, oh, this is really interesting. It's really cool. I'm not sure if it's necessarily the right thing for me. And then we rewrote the script for him because I was like, yes, this character is like obviously not someone that you could play because he's nuts. And you are clearly not, like, you were very put together. But we rewrote it for him, and then he agreed to do it. And, you know, there's things that Robert Redford, when you cast him in a movie, you just want to lean into. And that's like his legacy, the fact that he's like got this sort of a cinematic legend on screen. You don't want to pretend that he's not that. So you just lean into that a little bit. But at the same time, the great thing about this was he was working with kids who had no idea who he was. They don't have that same. They've known him from Captain America, and that's about it. And so it was so great. I think, and hopefully you'll get to talk to him today and find out if this is true. But I think it probably was kind of refreshing to like go in and work with these children who have no sense of like preciousness about who he is. They're not treating him with kid gloves because he's a movie star. Like, for me, going up to him, I'm a little nervous because I've seen all these movies like for the past, but for these kids, they didn't care. He was just another guy in the movie. And that, I think, allowed for a certain looseness that was really, really fun.
I noticed that a lot of times Elliot looked like a painting, but he was also in the forefront. So, it, like, you see him and he's like cuddly and cute and everything, but then sometimes he looked like a painting, adding a legendary status to the dragon. Was that done on purpose?
Sort of. I think if I understand the question correctly, it's sort of like he fits into his own iconography. We try to find these frames where he would just sort of fit the frame in a very iconic way. And there is a painterly quality of the light a lot of the times that gives it that sense too. I really like compositions that kind of define the silhouette of a character. So even if you're seeing all of them, like, you could squint your eyes and they still define themselves within that composition. And so with Elliot, you know, obviously he's big, so we'd have to get the camera pretty far back. But that was really important to me, that he would strike these poses that would be instantly recognizable and iconic. And even when he's taking off at the beginning, carrying Pete up into the sky, like, that's like, there's almost like a religious iconography at play in that image. Like, he feels like a guardian angel or something like that. And that was like an image that was important to get because you want to really sear this character into audiences' mind as quickly as possible.
Yeah,
I promised my daughter I would ask you this question.
Yes.
She wants to know why he glowed when Pete touched him.
Yeah. I think it could mean different things to different people. For me, it was when he feels safe with somebody or feels a connection to somebody, his fur changes color.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he turns invisible. He's like a camouflage thing going on. But I like the idea that we don't explain it, but that like the only two people that it happens with is Pete and Grace. And that both times he touches them, he turns like a deeper shade of green
mm-hmm.
that feels more positive and just to show that he feels a connection with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my answer. But I think we did a test screening of the movie and someone asked that question and this little boy in the audience just raised his hand and he beat everyone else to the question. He was like, "It's because of love."
Uh-huh.
And I was like, "That's you can't say anything better than that. That's the best answer."
She likes that. Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah.
With the look of Elliot, did you have a lot of input? How did Elliot come to look like he does for this film?
I went into the studio the very first time and was like, "He's going to be furry." That's like he's going to be a furry dragon. And they're like, "Great, that's cool." No one had any problem with that. And then the look kind of came from I did a drawing. Like, I'm not the best drawer, but I can kind of convey what I want. So I did a sketch of him that looks pretty much like he does right here. Like, it was like a very similar pose, a little boy and a dragon. And face was a little bit different, but by and large it was the same. And my brother did a lot of the concept art for this movie, so he started doing some paintings of that dragon. And then we got a lot of other concept artists involved just to see if we could push it in different directions. We got Brian Froud, who did all the designs for Labyrinth back in the day. That was really exciting for me. We had the gentleman who did the creatures for Pacific Rim. And we got a library full of like crazy cool designs, but ultimately it kind of came back to that initial drawing. Like, everything else was so... It would either be too outside the box or too weird. We found that if you mess with a dragon past a certain point, he ceases to be a dragon and becomes some other creature, whether it's a gremlin or a chimera or a griffin. And so there's certain things you just can't do. Like, the wings have to stay bat wings or leathery. The tail has to... He has to have a tail that's a certain length, and the proportions of the body need to feel a certain way for him to maintain his dragonish nature while also allowing us to do things like put fur on him. So then we finally came down to, like, a photoreal design that someone did for us that we then gave to Weta, and they finished it from there to make sure he could actually move and function in the real world. But it's not all that different from that initial sketch.
I'm not sure if I understood this correctly. You were originally just signed on to write the film. How
yeah.
did you transition to also directing?
I spent... My writing partner and I, Toby, like, you know, it was just an open writing assignment at Disney, and we went and met with the producers and met with the studio, and they were like, "Yeah, we like your version of it." They didn't have a story. They were just like... They were like, "What would you do?" And so we wrote it, and we spent a year working on the script. And at the end of that year, Jim Whitaker, the producer, asked me if I was interested in directing it. And that was the first time I thought about it, to be honest. Like, no one believes me when I say that, but I was like, to be honest, like, I didn't think I was going to be making this movie. And I had another movie I was probably planning on directing that was much darker and much smaller. But when this opportunity arose, I just realized, like, yeah, I didn't realize it, but this script has become incredibly personal to me, and I believe in it in a way that I don't necessarily want to see what someone else would do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, the best sign of, like, whether you should do a movie or not. Like, the other movie I was developing, I didn't feel bad letting it go, and another director has since made it. It's coming out later this year, and I'm very proud of the script, and I'm glad someone else did it, because I feel like they probably were able to commit to it better than I could. But with this one, I felt so much ownership over it and didn't even realize it. But when they asked me if I wanted to direct it, that was the first time I realized, oh yeah, maybe someone else will be directing this and I don't want them to. And so that was a sign to me that I should do this one.
Can you talk a little bit more about working with Weta and if you got any input from Peter Jackson?
You know, I didn't... I've still not met Peter.
Okay.
But I kept this diary throughout the entire production on my website. And I got an email from him saying that was one of the best best portrayals of what's like to direct a movie ever, and that just made my year. Like, just getting that, I was like, holy cow! And then we were supposed to have dinner last November in New Zealand, but we were doing some aerial photography for the movie, and I ended up getting stuck doing that and not getting to make that dinner, which was a real bummer. But working with Weta was great. And, you know, it's funny because I feel like growing up in the era of DVD, you kind of have an understanding of how these visual effects are done because there's so much supplementary material on DVDs and Blu-rays and on the internet now. And so I had a pretty clear idea of, like, what it would look like when I walked into Weta for the first time and what the artists are doing at their workstations and how they put the creature through the workflow and through the pipeline to get to the final stage. But at the same time, it was a completely new experience for me working with them in post. Production was pretty easy because you don't have a dragon there. You put a tennis ball on a stick or you have a big head. And we had a big head on a pole that we'd use sometimes, but not that often. But it's not that hard to do. But post-production was really tricky because you have to learn how to see things in a new way. You have to you'll see a shot and it won't look quite right, and you have to go through a rigorous process to figure out what doesn't look right about it. And sometimes it's the lighting, sometimes it's the colors are slightly off. It's always these little things, because technically you're saying, like, this dragon is amazing, it looks fantastic, but why doesn't it fit into the shot, into the plate right? And it takes a lot of trial and error to figure out what that is, and a lot of it comes down to your own personal taste. And that was an interesting learning curve, just learning how to see visual effects in a new way and to get them to a place that I was happy with, that Weta was happy with. And obviously they're like some of the best in the business, but they still have to solve new problems with every movie. So it's sort of like every movie they're starting over and trying things new for the first time. And so to be along with them on that process on this movie was really educational, really invaluable, and really inspiring.
Thank you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great.
Have a wonderful afternoon.
You too.
Great fun.
Thank you.
Congratulations.